checked her blandishments. He also knew, even better than I, that Jocasta Cameron was born a Mackenzie. I had seen enough of her brothers, Dougal and Colum, to have a decent wariness of that heritage. The Mackenzies of Leoch didn't give up a purpose lightly, and were certainly not above plotting and manipulation to achieve their ends. And a blind spider might weave her webs that much more surely, for depending solely on a sense of touch. There were also really excellent reasons for staying the hell away from the vicinity of Sergeant Murchison, who seemed definitely the type to bear a grudge. And then there was Farquhar Campbell, and the whole waiting web of planters and regulators, slaves and politics. No, I could see quite well why Jamie mightn't want to go back to such entanglement and complication, to say nothing of the looming fact of the coming war. At the same time, I was fairly sure that none of those reasons accounted for his decision. "It's not just that you don't want to go back to River Run, is it?" I leaned back against him, feeling his warmth as a contrast to the coolness of the evening breeze. The season hadn't yet turned. It was still late summer, and the air was rich with the sun-roused scents of leaf and berry. But so high in the mountains, the nights turned cold. I felt the small rumble of a laugh in his chest, and warm breath brushed my ear.
"Is it so plain, then?"
"Plain enough." I turned in his arms and rested my forehead against his, so our eyes were inches apart. His were a very deep blue, the same colour as the evening sky in the notch of the mountains.
"Owl," I said.
He laughed, startled, and blinked as he pulled back, long auburn lashes sweeping briefly down.
"What?"
"You lose," I explained. "It's a game called Owl. First person to blink loses."
"Oh."
He took hold of my ears by the lobes and drew me gently back, forehead to forehead.
"Owl, then. You do have eyes like an owl, have you noticed?"
"No,"
I said. "Can't say I have." "All clear and gold, and very wise."
I didn't blink. "Tell me, then, why we're staying." He didn't blink either, but I felt his chest rise under my hand as he took a deep breath.
"How shall I tell you what it is to feel the need of a place?"
he said softly.
"The need of snow beneath my shoon. The breath of the mountains breathing their own breath in my nostrils as God gave breath to Adam. The scrape of rock under my hand, climbing, and the sight of the lichens on it, enduring in the sun and the wind."
His breath was gone, and he breathed again, taking mine. His hands were linked behind my head, holding me, face to face.
"If I am to live as a man, I must have a mountain," he said simply.
His eyes were open wide, searching mine for understanding.
"Will you trust me, Sassenach?" he said.
His nose pressed against mine, but his eyes didn't blink. Neither did mine.
"With my life," I said.
I felt his lips smile an inch from mine.
"And with your heart?"
"Always," I whispered, and closed my eyes and kissed him. And so it was arranged. Myers would go back to Cross Creek, deliver Jamie's instructions to Duncan, assure Jocasta of our welfare, and procure as much in the way of stores as the remnants of our money would finance. If there was time before the first snowfall, he would return with supplies. If not, in the spring. Ian would stay. His help would be needed to build the cabin and to help with the hunting. "Give us this day our daily bread," I thought, pushing through the wet bushes that edged the creek, "and deliver us not into temptation." We were reasonably safe from temptation, though. For good or ill, we wouldn't see River Run again for at least a year. As for the daily bread, that had been coming through as dependably as manna, so far, At this time of year there was an abundance of ripe nuts, fruits and berries, which I collected as industriously as any squirrel. In 2 months, though, when the trees grew bare and the streams froze, I hoped God might still hear us above the howl of the winter wind. The stream was noticeably swelled by the rain, the water may be a foot higher than it had been yesterday. I knelt, groaning slightly as my back unkinked. Sleeping on the ground exaggerated all the normal small morning stiffnesses. I splashed cold water on my face, swished it through my mouth, drank from cupped hands, and splashed again, blood tingling through my cheeks and fingers. When I looked up, face dripping, I saw two deer drinking from a pool on the other side, a little way upstream from me. I stayed very still, not to disturb them, but they showed no alarm at my presence. In the shadow of the birches they were the same soft blue as the rocks and trees, little more than shadows themselves, but each line of their bodies etched in perfect delicacy, like a Japanese painting done in ink. Then, all of a sudden, they were gone. I blinked and blinked again. I hadn't seen them turn or run, and in spite of their ethereal beauty, I was sure I hadn't been imagining them. I could see the dark imprints of their hooves in the mud of the far bank. But they were gone. I didn't see or hear a thing, but the hair rose suddenly on my body, instinct rippling up arms and neck like electric current. I froze, nothing moving but my eyes. Where was it? What was it? The sun was up. The tops of the trees were visibly green, and the rocks began to glow as their colours warmed to life. But the birds were silent. Nothing moved, save the water. It was no more than 6 feet away from me, half visible behind a bush. The sound of its lapping was lost in the noise of the stream. Then the broad head lifted, and a tufted ear swiveled toward me, though I had made no noise. Could it hear me breathing? The sun had reached it, lit it into tawny life, glowed in gold eyes that stared into mine with a preternatural calm. The breeze had shifted. I could smell it now, a faint acrid cat tang and the stronger scent of blood. Ignoring me, it lifted a dark blotched paw and licked fastidiously, eyes slitted in hygienic preoccupation. It rubbed the paw several times over its ear, then stretched luxuriously in the patch of new sun. My God, it must be 6 feet long! And sauntered off, full belly swaying. I hadn't consciously been afraid. Pure instinct had frozen me in place, and sheer amazement at the cat's beauty, as well as its nearness, had kept me that way. With its going, though, my central nervous system thawed out at once and promptly went to pieces. I didn't gibber, but did shake considerably. It was several minutes before I managed to get off my knees and stand up. My hand shook so that I dropped the kettle 3 times in filling it. "Trust him," he'd said. Did I trust him? Yes, I did, and a fat lot of good that would do, unless he happened to be standing directly in front of me next time. But for this time, I was alive. I stood still, eyes closed, breathing in the pure morning air. I could feel every single atom of my body, blood racing to carry round the sweet fresh stuff to every cell and muscle fibre. The sun touched my face and warmed the cold skin to a lovely glow. I opened my eyes to a dazzle of green and yellow and blue. Day had broken. All the birds were singing now. I went up the path toward the clearing, resisting the impulse to look behind me. Jamie and Ian had felled several tall, slender pines the day before, cut them into 12-foot lengths, and rolled and wrestled and tumbled the logs downhill. Now they lay stacked at the edge of the small clearing, rough bark glistening black with wet. Jamie was pacing out a line, stamping down the wet grass, when I came back with the kettle filled with water. Ian had a fire started on the top of a large flat stone. He, having learned from Jamie the canny trick of keeping a handful of dry kindling always in one sporran, along with flint and steel.
"This will be a wee shed," Jamie was saying, frowning at the ground in concentration. "We'll build this first, for we can sleep in it if it should rain again. But it needna be so well built as the cabin. It'll give us something to practice on, eh, Ian?"
"What is it for, beyond practice?" I asked. He looked up and smiled at me.
"Good morning, Sassenach. Did you sleep well?"
"Of course not," I said. "What's the shed for?"
"Meat," he said. "We'll dig a shallow pit at the back and fill it wi' embers to smoke what we can for keeping. And make a rack for drying. Ian's seen the Indians do it, to make what they call jerky. We must have a safe place where the beasts canna get at our food."
This seemed a sound idea, particularly in view of the sort of beasts in the area. My only doubts were regarding the smoking. I'd seen it done in Scotland, and knew that smoking meat required a certain amount of attention. Someone had to be at hand to keep the fire from burning too high or going out altogether, had to turn the meat regularly, and baste it with fat to avoid scorching and drying. I had no difficulty in seeing who was going to be nominated for this task. The only trouble was that if I didn't manage to do it right, we'd all die of ptomaine poisoning.
"Right," I said, without enthusiasm.
Jamie caught my tone and grinned at me.
"That's the first shed, Sassenach," he said. "The second one's yours."
"Mine?"
I perked up a bit at that. "For your wee herbs and bits of plants. They do take up a bit of room, as I recall."
He pointed across the clearing, the light of builder's mania in his eye.
"And just there, that's where the cabin will be. Where we'll live through the winter."
Rather to my surprise, they had the walls of the first shed erected by the end of the second day, crudely roofed with cut branches until time should permit the cutting of shingles for a proper roof. The walls were made of slender notched logs, still with the bark on, and with noticeable chinks and gaps between them. Still, it was large enough to sleep the three of us, and Rollo, comfortably. And with a fire burning in a stone-lined pit at one end, it was quite cosy inside. Enough branches had been removed from the roof to leave a smoke hole. I could see the evening stars as I cuddled against Jamie and listened to him criticize his workmanship.
"Look at that," he said crossly, lifting his chin at the far corner. "I've gone and laid in a crooked pole, and it's put the whole of that line off the street."
"I don't imagine the deer carcasses will care," I murmured. "Here, let's see that hand."
"And the roof tree's a good 6 inches lower at the one end than the other," he went on,
ignoring me, but letting me have his left hand. Both hands were smoothly calloused, but I could feel the new roughnesses of scrapes and cuts, and so many small splinters that his palm was prickly to the touch.
"You feel like a porcupine," I said, brushing my hand over his fingers.
"Here, move closer to the fire so I can see to pull them out." He moved obligingly, crawling around Ian, who, freshly desplintered himself, had fallen asleep with his head pillowed on Rollo's furry side. Unfortunately, the change of position exposed new weaknesses of construction to Jamie's critical eye.
"You've never built a shed out of logs before, have you?" I interrupted his denunciation of the doorway, neatly tweaking a large splinter out of his thumb with my tweezers.
"Ow!
No, but..."
"And you built the bloody thing in 2 days with nothing but a felling axe and a knife, for God's sake. There's not a nail in it. Why ought you to expect it to look like Buckingham Palace?"
"I've never seen Buckingham Palace," he said, rather mildly.
He paused.
"I do take your point, though, Sassenach."
"Good." I bent closely over his palm, squinting to make out the small dark streaks of splinters trapped beneath the skin.
"I suppose it willna fall down, at least," he said, after a longer pause.
"Shouldn't think so." I dabbed a cloth to the neck of the brandy bottle, swabbed his hand with it, then turned my attention to his right hand. He didn't speak for a time. The fire crackled softly to itself, flaring up now and then as a draught reached in between the logs to tickle it.
"The house is going to be on the high ridge," he said suddenly, "where the strawberries grow."
"Well, it," I murmured. "The cabin, you mean? I thought that was going to be at the side of the clearing." I'd taken out as many splinters as I could. Those that were left were so deeply embedded that I would have to wait for them to work their way nearer the surface.
"No, not the cabin.
A fine house," he said softly. He leaned back against the rough logs, looking across the fire, out through the chinks to the darkness beyond.
"With a staircase and glass windows."
"That will be grand." I laid the tweezers back in their slot and closed the box.
"With high ceilings and a doorway high enough I shall never bump my head going in."
"That will be lovely." I leaned back beside him and rested my head on his shoulder. Somewhere in the far distance a wolf howled. Rollo lifted his head with a soft woof, listened for a moment, then lay down again with a sigh.
"With a still room for you and a study for me, lined with shelves for my books."
At the moment, he possessed one book, The Natural History of North Carolina, published 1733, brought along as guide and reference. The fire was burning low again, but neither of us moved to add more wood. The embers would warm us through the night, to be rekindled with the dawn. Jamie put an arm around my shoulders, and, tilting sideways, took me with him to lie curled together on the thick layer of fallen leaves that was our couch.
"And a bed," I said. "You could build a bed, I expect."
"As fine as any in Buckingham Palace," he said.
Myers, bless his kindly heart and faithful nature, did return within the month, bringing not only 3 pack mules laden with tools, small furnishings, and necessities such as salt, but also Duncan Innes.
"Here?"
Innes looked interestedly over the tiny homestead that had begun to take shape on the strawberry-covered ridge. We had 2 sturdy sheds now, plus a split-railed penfold in which to keep the horses and any other stock we might acquire. At the moment, our total stock consisted of a small white piglet which Jamie had obtained from a Moravian settlement 30 miles away. Exchanging for it a bag of sweet yams I had gathered, and a bundle of willow twig brooms I had made. Rather too small for the penfold, it had so far been living in the shed with us, where it had become fast friends with Rollo. I wasn't quite so fond of it myself.
"Aye, it's decent land with plenty of water. There are springs in the wood and a creek all through."
Jamie guided Duncan to a spot from which the western slopes below the ridge were visible. There were natural breaks or coves in the forest, now overgrown with tangles of wild grass, but ultimately suitable for cultivation.
"Do you see?"
He gestured over the slope, which ran down gently from the ridge to a small bluff, where a line of sycamores marked the distant river's edge.
"There's room there for at least 30 homesteads to start. We'd need to clear a deal of forest, but there's space enough to begin. Any crofter worth his salt could feed his family from a garden plot, the soil's so rich."
Duncan had been a fisherman, not a farmer, but he nodded obediently, eyes fixed on the vista as Jamie peopled it with future houses.
"I've pieced it out," Jamie was saying, "though it will have to be surveyed properly as soon as maybe. But I've the description of it in my head. Did you by chance bring ink and paper?" "Aye, we did. And a few other things as well."
Duncan smiled at me, his long, rather melancholy face transformed by the expression.
"Miss Jo's sent a feather bed which she thought might not come amiss."
"A feather bed? Really? How wonderful!" I immediately dismissed any ungenerous thoughts I had ever harboured about Jocasta Cameron.
While Jamie had built us an excellent sturdy bedstead, framed in oak wood, with the bottom ingeniously made of laced rope, I had had nothing to lay on it save cedar branches, which were fragrant but unpleasantly lumpy. My thoughts of luxuriant wallowing were interrupted by the emergence from the woods of Ian and Myers, the latter with a brace of squirrels hung from his belt. Ian proudly presented me with an enormous black object which on closer inspection proved to be a turkey, fat from gorging on the autumn grains.
"Boy's got a nice eye, Mrs. Clare," said Myers, nodding approvingly. "Those be wily birds, turkeys. Even the Indians don't take 'em easy."
It was early for Thanksgiving, but I was delighted with the bird, which would be the first substantial item in our larder. So was Jamie, though his pleasure lay more in the thing's tail feathers, which would provide him with a good supply of quills.
"I must write to the governor," he explained over dinner, "to see that I shall be taking up his offer, and to give the particulars of the land."
He picked up a chunk of cake and bit into it absently.
"Do watch out for nutshells," I said a little nervously. "You don't want to break a tooth."
Dinner consisted of trout grilled over the fire, yams baked in it, wild plums, and a very crude cake made of flour from hickory nuts ground up in my mortar. We had been living mostly on fish and what edible vegetation I could scrounge, Ian and Jamie having been too busy with the building to take time to hunt. I rather hoped that Myers would see fit to stay for a bit, long enough to bag a deer or some other nice large source of protein. A winter of dried fish seemed a little daunting.
"To the fash, Sassenach," Jamie murmured through a mouthful of cake and smiled at me. "That's good."
He turned his attention to Duncan.
"When we've done with eating, Duncan, you'll maybe walk with me to the river and choose your place."
Innes's face went blank, then flushed with a mixture of pleasure and dismay.
"My place? Land, you mean, MacDhu?"
Involuntarily, he hunched the shoulder on the side with a missing arm.
"Aye, land."
Jamie speared a hot yam with a sharpened stick and began to peel it carefully with his fingers, not looking at Innes.
"I shall be needing you to act as my agent, Duncan, if you will. It's only right you should be paid. Now, what I am thinking, if you should find it fair, mind, is that I shall make the claim for a homestead in your name, but as you will not be here to work it, Ian and I will see to putting a bit of your land to corn and to building a wee croft there. Then, come time, you shall have a place to settle, if you like, and a bit of corn put by. Will that suit you, do you think?"
Duncan's face had been going through an array of emotions as Jamie spoke, from dismay to amazement to a cautious sort of excitement. The last thing that would ever have occurred to him was that he might own land. Penniless and unable to work with his hands, in Scotland he would have lived as a beggar, if he had lived at all.
"Why,"
he began, then stopped and swallowed, knobbly Adam's apple bobbing.
"Aye, MacDhu, that will suit fine."
A small incredulous smile had formed on his face as Jamie spoke, and stayed there, as though Duncan were unaware of it.
"Agent?"
He swallowed again, and reached for one of the bottles of ale he had brought.
"What will you have me to do for you, MacDhu?" "The two things, Duncan, and you will. First is to find me settlers."
Jamie waved a hand at the beginnings of our new cabin, which so far consisted entirely of a fieldstone foundation, the framing of the floor, and a wide slab of dark slate selected for the hearthstone, presently leaning against the foundation.
"I cannot be leaving here just at present myself. What I want you to do is to find as many as you can of the men who were transported from Ardsmuir. They'll have been scattered, but they came through Wilmington, and many of them will be in North or South Carolina. Find as many as you can, tell them what I'm about here, and bring as many as are willing here in the spring."
Duncan was nodding slowly,
lips pursed beneath his drooping moustache. Few men wore such facial adornment, but it suited him, making him look like a thin but benevolent walrus.
"Very well," he said. "I'm the second."
Jamie glanced at me, then at Duncan.
"My aunt," he said. "Will you undertake to help her, Duncan? She's great need of an honest man who can deal with the naval bastards and speak for her in business."
Duncan had showed no hesitation in agreeing to comb several hundred miles of colony in search of settlers for our enterprise, but the notion of dealing with naval bastards struck him with profound uneasiness.
"Business? But then I ken what of."
"Then a fash," Jamie said, smiling at his friend, and the adjuration worked on Duncan as well as it did on me. I could see the mounting uneasiness in Duncan's eyes begin to recede. For roughly the 10,000th time, I wondered how he did it.
"It'll be little trouble to you," Jamie said soothingly. "My aunt kens well enough what's to be done. She can tell you what to see and what to do. It's only she needs a man for the seeing and doing of it. I shall write a letter to her for you to take back, explaining that you'll be pleased to act for her."
During the latter part of this conversation, Ian had been digging about in the packs that had been unloaded from the mules. Now he withdrew a flat piece of metal and squinted at it curiously.
"What's this?"
he asked of no one in particular. He held it out for us to see. A flat piece of dark metal, pointed at one end like a knife, with rudimentary cross pieces. It looked like a small dirk that had been run over by a steamroller.
"Iron for your half."
Duncan reached for the piece and handed it handle first to Jamie.
"That was Miss Jo's thought."
"Was it? That was kind."
Jamie's face was weathered to deep bronze by long days in the open, but I saw the faint flush of pink on the side of his neck. His thumb stroked the smooth surface of the iron, and then he handed it to me.
"Keep it safe, Sassenach," he said. "We'll bless our hearth before Duncan leaves."
I could see that he was deeply touched by the gift, but didn't understand entirely why, until Ian had explained to me that one buries iron beneath a new hearth to ensure blessing and prosperity on the house. It was Jocasta's blessing on our venture, her acceptance of Jamie's decision, and forgiveness for what must have seemed his abandonment. It was more than generosity, and I folded the small piece of iron carefully into my handkerchief and put it in my pocket for safekeeping. We blessed the hearth 2 days later, standing in the wall-less cabin. Myers had removed his hat from respect, and Ian had washed his face. Rollo was present too, as was the small white pig, who was required to attend as the personification of our flocks, despite her objections. The pig saw no point in being removed from her meal of acorns to participate in a ritual so notably lacking in food. Ignoring piercing pig screams of annoyance, Jamie held the small iron knife upright by its tip, so that it formed a cross, and said quietly,
"God bless the world and all that is therein. God bless my spouse and my children. God bless the eye that is in my head. And bless God the handling of my hand. What time I rise in the morning early, what time I lie down late in bed. Bless my rising in the morning early, and my lying down late in bed."
He reached out and touched first me, then Ian, and with a grin, Rollo and the pig, with the iron, before going on.
"God protect the house and the household. God consecrate the children of the motherhood. God encompass the flocks and the young. Be thou after them and tending them. What time the flocks ascend hill and wold. What time I lie down to sleep. What time the flocks ascend hill and wold. What time I lie down in peace to sleep. Let the fire of thy blessing burn for ever upon us, O God."
He knelt then by the hearth and placed the iron into the small hole dug for it, covered it over, and tamped the dirt flat. Then he and I took the ends of the big hearthstone and laid it carefully into place. I should have felt quite ridiculous, standing in a house with no walls, attended by a wolf and a pig, surrounded by wilderness and mocked by mockingbirds, engaged in a ritual more than half-pagan. I didn't. Jamie stood in front of the new hearth, stretched out a hand to me, and drew me to stand by the hearthstone beside him. Looking down at the slate before us, I suddenly thought of the abandoned homestead we had found on our journey north, the fallen timbers of the roof, and the cracked hearthstone from which a holly bush had sprouted. Had the unknown founders of that place thought to bless their hearth, and failed anyway? Jamie's hand tightened on mine in unconscious reassurance. On a flat rock outside the cabin, Duncan kindled a small fire, Myers holding the steel for him to strike. Once begun, the fire was coaxed into brightness and a brand taken from it. Duncan held this in his one hand and walked sunwise around the cabin's foundation, chanting in loud Gaelic. Jamie translated for me as he sang.
The safeguard of Fionn Mac Cumhail be yours. The safeguard of Cormac the Shapely be yours. The safeguard of Conn and Cumhail be yours, from wolf and from bird flock, from wolf and from bird flock.
He paused in his chanting as he came to each point of the compass, and bowing to the four heirs, swept his brand in a blazing arc before him.
Rollo, plainly disapproving of these pyromaniac goings-on, growled deep in his throat, but was firmly shushed by Ian. The shield of the King of Fionn be yours. The shield of the King of the Sun be yours. The shield of the King of the Stars be yours. In jeopardy and distress. In jeopardy and distress.
There were a good many verses. Duncan circled the house three times. It was only as he reached the final point, next to the freshly laid hearthstone, that I realized Jamie had laid out the cabin so that the hearth lay to the north. The morning sun fell warm on my left shoulder and threw our mingled shadows to the west.
The sheltering of the King of Kings be yours. The sheltering of Jesus Christ be yours. The sheltering of the Spirit of Healing be yours. From evil deed and quarrel. From evil dog and red dog.
With a look down his nose at Rollo, Duncan stopped by the hearth and gave the brand to Jamie, who stooped in turn and set alight the waiting pile of kindling. Ian gave a Gaelic whoop as the flame blazed up, and there was general applause. Later, we saw Duncan and Myers off. They were bound not for Cross Creek, but rather for Mount Helicon, where the Scots of the region held a yearly gathering in the autumn to give thanks for successful harvests, to exchange news and transact business, to celebrate marriages and christenings, to keep the far-flung elements of clan and family in touch. Jocasta and her household would be there, so would Farquhar Campbell and Andrew MacNeil. It was the best place for Duncan to begin his task of finding the scattered men of Ardsmuir. Mount Helicon was the largest of the gatherings. Scots would come there from as far away as South Carolina and Virginia.
"I shall be here come spring, MacDhu," Duncan promised Jamie as he mounted, "with as many men as I can fetch to you. And I shall hand on your letters without fail."
He patted the pouch by his saddle and tugged his hat down to shade his eyes from the rich September sun.
"Will you have a word for your aunt?"
Jamie paused for a moment, thinking. He had written to Jocasta already. Was there anything to add?
"Tell my aunt I shall not see her at the gathering this year, or perhaps at the next. But the one after that, I shall be there without fail, and my people with me. Godspeed, Duncan."
He slapped Duncan's horse on the rump and stood by me, waving as the two horses dropped over the edge of the ridge and out of sight. The parting gave me an odd feeling of desolation. Duncan was our last and only link with civilization. Now we were truly alone.
"Not quite alone," I amended. We had Ian, to say nothing of Rollo, the pig, 3 horses, and 2 mules that Duncan had left us to manage the spring ploughing. Quite a little establishment, in fact. My spirits rose in contemplation. Within a month, the cabin would be finished, and we would have a solid roof over our heads. And then...
"Bad news, Auntie," said Ian's voice in my ear. "The pig's eaten the rest of your nut meal."
Chapter 20. The White Raven. October 1767.
"Body, soul, and mind,"
Jamie said, translating as he bent to seize the end of another untrimmed log.
"The body for sensation, the soul for the springs of action, the mind for principles. Yet the capacity for sensation belongs also to the stalled ox. There is no wild beast or degenerate but obeys the twitchings of impulse. And even men who deny the gods or betray their country or... Careful, man!"
Ian, thus warned, stepped neatly backward over the axe handle and turned to the left, steering his end of the burden carefully round the corner of the half-built log wall.
"Or perpetrate all manner of villainy behind locked doors, have minds to guide them to the clear path of duty."
Jamie resumed Marcus Aurelius's meditations.
"Seeing, then. Step up. Aye, good, that's got it. Seeing, then, that all else is in common heritage of such types, the good man's only singularity lies in his approving welcome to every experience the looms of fate may weave for him, his refusal to soil the divinity seated in his breast, or perturb it with disorderly impressions. All right now, 1 and 2 and... Ooh!"
His face went scarlet with effort as they reached the proper position and, in concert, hoisted the squared log to shoulder height. Too occupied to go on with the meditations of Marcus Aurelius, Jamie directed his nephew's movements with jerks of the head and breathless one-word commands as they manoeuvred the unwieldy chunk of wood into the notches of the cross-pieces below it.
"Ooh, the twitchings of impulse, is it?"
Ian shouldered a lock of hair out of his sweating face.
"I feel a wee twitch in the direction of my weem. Is that degenerate, then?" "I believe that would be an acceptable bodily sensation at this time of day,"
Jamie allowed, grunting slightly as they manoeuvred the log the last inch into place.
"A bit to the left, Ian."
The log dropped into its notches, and both men stepped back with a shared sigh of relieved accomplishment. Ian grinned at his uncle.
"Meaning you're hungry yourself, eh?"
Jamie grinned back, but before he could reply, Rollo lifted his head, ears perking, and a low growl rumbled in his chest. Seeing this, Ian turned his head to look, and stopped in the act of mopping his face with his shirt tail.
"Here's company, Uncle,"
he said, nodding toward the forest. Jamie stiffened. Before he could turn or reach for a weapon, though, I had made out what Rollo and Ian had seen among the shifting leaf-light.
"Not to worry," I said, amused. "It's your erstwhile drinking companion, dressed for visiting. Little something the looms of fate have woven for your approving welcome, I expect."
Nacognowito waited politely in the shade of the chestnut grove until he was sure we had seen him. Then he advanced slowly out of the forest, followed this time not by his sons, but by 3 women, 2 of them carrying large bundles on their backs. One was a young girl, no more than 13 or so, and the second, in her 30s, plainly the girl's mother. The 3rd woman who accompanied them was much older. Not the grandmother, I thought, seeing her bent form and white hair. Perhaps the great-grandmother. They had indeed come dressed for visiting. Nacognowito was bare-legged, with leather buskins on his feet, but he wore muslin breeches, loose at the knee, and a shirt of dyed pink linen over them, belted splendidly with a girdle studded with porcupine quills and bits of white and lavender shell. Over it all, he had a leather vest with beaded trim, and a sort of loose turban in blue calico over his unbound hair, with two crow's feathers dangling down beside one ear. Jewellery of shell and silver, an earring, several necklaces, a belt buckle, and small ornaments tied to his hair completed the picture. The women were somewhat less gorgeously arrayed, but still plainly in their Sunday best, in long loose dresses that reached their knees, soft boots and leather leggings showing beneath. They were girdled with deer leather aprons decorated with painted patterns, and the two younger women wore ornamental vests as well. They advanced in single file, halfway across the clearing, then stopped.
"My God," Jamie murmured, "it's an ambassage."
He wiped a sleeve across his face and nudged Ian in the ribs.
"Meet my curtsies, Ian, I'll be back."
Ian, looking a trifle bewildered, advanced to meet the Indians, waving a large hand in a ceremonial gesture of welcome. Jamie grabbed me by the arm and hustled me round the corner into the half-built house. "What?" I began, bewildered.
"Get dressed,"
he interrupted, shoving the clothes box in my direction.
"Put on your gaudiest things, aye. It wouldn't have been respectful else."
Gaudy was going a bit far in the description of any item of my current wardrobe, but I did my best, hastily tying a yellow linen skirt around my waist and replacing my plain white kerchief with one Jocasta had sent me, embroidered with cherries. I thought that would do. After all, it was obviously the males of the species who were on display here. Jamie, having flung off his breeks and belted his crimson plaid in record time, fastened it with a small bronze brooch, snatched a bottle from under the bed frame, and was out through the open side of the house before I had finished tidying my hair. Giving up that attempt as a lost cause, I hurried out after him. The women watched me with the same fascination I had for them, but they hung back as Jamie and Cognoito conducted the necessary greetings involving the ceremonial pouring and sharing of the brandy, Ian being included in this ritual. Only then did the second woman come forward at Nacognowito's gesture, ducking her head in shy acknowledgement.
"Bonjour, monsieur, madame,"
she said softly, looking from one to another of us. Her eyes rested on me with frank curiosity, taking in every detail of my appearance, so I felt no compunction in staring at her likewise. Mixed blood, I thought. Perhaps French?
"Je suis sa femme,"
she said, with a graceful inclination of her head toward Nacognowito, the words verifying my guess as to her heritage.
"Je m'appelle Gabrielle."
"Je m'appelle Claire,"
I said, with a slightly less graceful gesture at myself.
"S'il vous plaît."
I waved at the pile of waiting logs, inviting them to sit down, while mentally wondering whether there was enough of the squirrel stew to go round. Jamie, meanwhile, was eyeing Nacognowito with a mixture of amusement and irritation.
"Oh, no French, is it?" he said. "Not a word, then, I suppose."
The Indian gave him a look of profound blandness and nodded to his wife to continue with the introductions. The elder lady was Nayaweni, not Gabrielle's grandmother, as I had thought, but rather Nacognowito's. This lady was light-boned, thin, and bent with rheumatism, but bright-eyed as the sparrow she so strongly resembled. She wore a small leather bag tied round her neck, ornamented with a rough green stone pierced through for stringing, and the spotted tail feathers of a woodpecker. She had a larger bag, this one of cloth, tied at her waist. She saw me looking at the green stains on the rough cloth, and smiled, showing two prominent yellow front teeth. The girl was, as I had surmised, Gabrielle's daughter, but not, I thought, Nacognowito's. She had no resemblance to him, and behaved shyly toward him. Her rather incongruous name was Bertha, and the effects of mixed blood were even more apparent in her than in her mother. Her hair was dark and silky, but a deep brown rather than ebony, and her round face was ruddy, with the fresh complexion of a European, though her eyes had the Indian's epicanthic fold. Once the official introductions were over, Nacognowito motioned to Bertha, who obediently brought out the large bundle she had carried, and opened it at my feet, displaying a large basket of orange and green striped squash, a string of dried fish, a smaller basket of yams, and a huge pile of Indian corn, shucked and dried on the cob. "My God," I murmured, "the return of Squanto." Everyone gave me a blank look, and I hastened to smile and make exclamations, thoroughly heartfelt, of joy and pleasure over the gifts. It might not get us through the whole winter, but it was enough to augment our diet for a good 2 months. Now Cognowito explained through Gabrielle that this was a small and insignificant return for Jamie's gift of the bear, which had been received with delight by his village, where Jamie's courageous exploit— here the women cut their eyes at me and tittered, having evidently heard all about the episode of the fish— had been the subject of great talk and admiration. Jamie, thoroughly accustomed to this sort of diplomatic exchange, modestly disclaimed any pretension to prowess, dismissing the encounter as the merest accident. While Gabrielle was employed in translation, the old lady ignored the mutual compliments and sidled crabwise over to me. Without the least sense of offence, she patted me familiarly all over, fingering my clothes and lifting the hem of my dress to examine my shoes, keeping up a running commentary to herself in a soft, hoarse murmur. The murmur grew louder and took on a tone of astonishment when she got to my hair. I obligingly took out the pins and shook it down over my shoulders. She pulled out a curl, drew it taut, then let it spring back and laughed like a drain. The men glanced in our direction, but by this time Jamie had moved on to showing Nacognowito the construction of the house. The chimney was complete, built of fieldstone like the foundation, and the floor had been laid, but the walls, built of solid squared logs, each some 8 inches in diameter, rose only shoulder high. Jamie was urging Ian to a demonstration of the debarking of logs, in which he chopped his way steadily backward as he walked along the top of the log, narrowly missing his toes with each stroke. This form of male conversation, requiring no translation, Gabrielle was left free to come and chat with me. Though her French was peculiarly accented and full of strange idioms, we had no trouble understanding each other. In fairly short order, I discovered that Gabrielle was the daughter of a French fur trader and a Huron woman, and the second wife of Nacognowito, who in turn was her second husband. The first, Berthe's father, had been a Frenchman, killed in the French and Indian War 10 years before. They lived in a village called Anauka. I bit the inside of my cheek to keep a straight face. No doubt New Bern would have sounded peculiar to them, some 2 days' travel to the northwest. Gabrielle indicated the direction with a graceful inclination of her head. While I talked with Gabrielle and Bertha, augmenting the conversation by means of hand-waving, I slowly became conscious that another sort of communication was taking place with the old lady. She said nothing to me directly, though she murmured now and then to Bertha, plainly demanding to know what I had said. But her bright dark eyes stayed fixed on me, and I was peculiarly aware of her regard. I had the odd feeling that she was talking to me, and I to her, without the exchange of a single spoken word. I saw Jamie, across the clearing, offering Nacognowito the rest of the bottle of brandy. Clearly it was time to offer gifts in return. I gave Gabrielle the embroidered kerchief, and Bertha a hairpin ornamented with paste brilliance, over which gifts they exclaimed in pleasure. For Nayawene, though, I had something different. I had been fortunate enough to find 4 large ginseng roots the week before. I fetched all 4 from my medicine chest and pressed them into her hands, smiling. She looked back at me, then grinned, and untying the cloth bag from her belt, thrust it at me. I didn't have to open it. I could feel the 4 long, lumpy shapes through the cloth. I laughed in return, Yes, we definitely spoke the same language. Moved by curiosity and by an impulse that I couldn't describe, I asked Gabrielle about the old lady's amulet, hoping that this wasn't an insufferable breach of good manners.
Grand-mère est...
She hesitated, looking for the right French word, but I already knew.
Pas docteur, I said, et pas sorcière, magicienne, elle est...
I hesitated too. There really wasn't a suitable word for it in French after all.
We say she is a singer,
Berthe put in shyly, in French.
We call it Shaman. Her name, it means, it may be, it will happen.
The old lady said something, nodding at me, and the two younger women looked startled.
Nyawenny bent her head, slipped the thong off her neck, and placed the little bag in my hand. It was so heavy that my wrist sagged and I nearly dropped it. Astonished, I closed my hand over it. The worn leather was warm from her body, the rounded contours fitting smoothly into my palm. For just a moment, I had the remarkable impression that something in the bag was alive.
My face must have shown my startlement, for the old lady doubled up laughing. She held out her hand, and I gave her back the amulet with a fair amount of haste. Gabrielle conveyed politely that her husband's grandmother would be pleased to show me the useful plants that grew nearby, if I would like to walk with her. I accepted this invitation with alacrity, and the old lady set off up the path with a sure-footed spryness that belied her years. I watched her feet, tiny in soft leather boots, and hoped that when I was her age I might be capable of walking for 2 days through the woods and then wanting to go exploring. We wandered along the stream for some way, followed at a respectful distance by Gabrielle and Berthe, who came up beside us only if summoned to interpret.
"Each of the plants holds the cure to a sickness," the old lady explained through Gabrielle.
She plucked a twig from a bush by the path and handed it to me with a wry look.
"If we only knew what they all were."
For the most part, we managed fairly well by means of gesture, but when we reached the big pool where Jamie and Ian fished trout, Nyawenny stopped and waved, bringing Gabrielle to us again. She said something to the woman, who turned to me, a faint look of surprise on her face.
"My husband's grandmother says that she had a dream about you on the night of the full moon, 2 moons ago."
"About me?"
Gabrielle nodded. Nyawenny put a hand on my arm and looked up intently into my face, as though to see the impact of Gabrielle's words.
"She told us about the dream, that she had seen a woman with..."
Her lips twitched, then hastily straightened themselves, and she delicately touched the ends of her own long, straight hair.
"3 days later, my husband and his sons returned to tell of meeting you and the bear killer in the forest."
Berthe was watching me with frank interest too, twining a lock of her own dark brown hair around the end of an index finger.
"She who healed said at once that she must see you, and so when we heard that you were here..."
That gave me a small start. I had had no sensation of being watched, and yet plainly someone had taken note of our presence on the mountain and conveyed the news to Nacognowito. Impatient with these irrelevancies, Nyawenny poked her granddaughter-in-law and said something, then pointed firmly at the water by our feet.
"My husband's grandmother says that when she dreamed of you, it was here."
Gabrielle gestured over the pool and looked back at me with great seriousness.
"She met you here, at night. The moon was in the water. You became a white raven. You flew over the water and swallowed the moon."
"Oh?"
I hope this wasn't a sinister thing for me to have done.
"The white raven flew back and laid an egg in the palm of her hand. The egg split open, and there was a shining stone inside. My husband's grandmother knew this was great magic, that the stone could heal sickness."
Nyawenny nodded her head several times,
and taking the amulet bag from her neck, reached into it. On the day after the dream, my husband's grandmother went to dig kinia root, and on the way she saw something blue sticking in the clay of the river bank. Nayawenny drew out a small lumpy object and dropped it into my hand. It was a pebble, rough, but undeniably a gemstone. Bits of stony matrix clung to it, but the heart of the rock was a deep, soft blue. My goodness! It's a sapphire, isn't it? Sapphire. Gabrielle turned the word over in her mouth, tasting it. We call it... She hesitated, looking for the proper French translation. Pierre sans peur.
Pierre sans peur?
A fearless stone. Nayawenny nodded, talking again.
Bertha butted in with a translation before her mother could speak.
My father's grandmother says a stone like this, it keeps people from being afraid, and so it makes their spirit strong, so they will be healed more easily. Already this stone has healed 2 people of fever and cured a soreness of the eyes that my younger brother had. My husband's grandmother wishes to thank you for this gift.
Gabrielle neatly took back the conversation. Do tell her she's quite welcome.
I nodded cordially at the old lady and gave her back the blue stone. She popped it into the bag and drew the string tight about its neck. Then she peered closely at me and, reaching out, drew down a curl of my hair, talking as she rubbed the lock between her fingers. My husband's grandmother says that you have medicine now, but you will have more. When your hair is white like hers, that is when you will find your full power. The old lady dropped the lock of hair and looked into my eyes for a moment. I thought I saw an expression of great sadness in the faded depths, and reached involuntarily to touch her. She stepped back and said something else. Gabrielle looked at me queerly.
She says you must not be troubled. Sickness is sent from the gods. It won't be your fault.
I looked at Nayawenny, startled, but she had already turned away. "'What won't be my fault?' I asked. But the old lady refused to say more.
Chapter 21 Night on a Snowy Mountain December 1767 The winter held off for some time, but snow began to fall in the night on November the 28th, and we woke to find the world transformed. Every needle on the great blue spruce behind the cabin was frosted, and ragged fringes of ice dripped from the tangle of wild raspberry canes. The snow wasn't deep, but its coming changed the shape of daily life. I no longer foraged during the day, save for short trips to the stream for water, and for lingering bits of green cress salvaged from the icy slush along the banks. Jamie and Ian ceased their work of log-felling and field-clearing, and turned to roof-shingling. The winter drew in on us, and we in turn withdrew from the cold, turning inward. We had no candles, only grease lamps and rush lights, and the light of the fire that burned constantly on the hearth, blackening the roof-beams. We therefore rose at first light and lay down after supper, in the same rhythm as the creatures of the forest around us. We had no sheep yet, and thus no wool to card or spin, no cloth to weave or dye. We had no beehives yet, and thus no wax to boil, no candles to dip. There was no stock to care for, save the horses and mules and the piglet, who had grown considerably in both size and irascibility, and in consequence had been exiled to a private compartment in the corner of the crude stable Jamie had built. This itself no more than a large open-fronted shelter with a branch-covered roof. Myers had brought a small but useful selection of tools, the iron parts clanking in a bag, to be supplied with wooden handles from the forest close at hand, a barking axe and another felling axe, a ploughshare for the spring planting, augers, planes and chisels, a small grass scythe,
two hammers and a handsaw. A peculiar thing called a twibble that Jamie said was for cutting mortises. A draw knife, a curved blade with handles at either end, used to smooth and taper wood. Two small sharp knives, a hatchet